Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Tehran, Iran, and speak with Ali Arouzi, who is the NBC bureau chief in Tehran and one of the few Western journalists operating in that country. We will discuss the arrival of UN inspectors in Iran and the brinksmanship over the increasingly severe sanctions that might lead Iran to cut off oil to its European customers who have joined the US in these sanctions. Then we'll get another perspective on the growing tensions between Iran and the West with Kelly Galnoush Niknijad, who is the editor-in-chief of Tehran Bureau, an independent source of news on Iran that is in partnership with PBS's Frontline. We'll discuss the recent report in the New York Times that Israeli war planners think a limited attack on Iran may not lead to the catastrophic consequences many are predicting. Then finally, we'll go to Cairo, Egypt, and speak with Sharif Geber, who is an independent blogger active with the group No Military Trials for Civilians. We'll discuss the standoff between the demonstrators in Tahrir Square and the ruling military regime that is reluctant to cede power and is holding the son of a cabinet secretary in the Obama White House, claiming foreign interference in an attempt to distract angry Egyptians from the regime's intransigence. Joining us now is Ali Arouzi, who is the NBC bureau chief in Tehran, in Iran. He's one of the few Western journalists operating in that country. He was born in Iran, and his family moved to London when the Islamic revolutionaries deposed the Shah. He first returned to his native country in 2004 to report on the massive Iranian earthquake and has since become one of NBC's chief correspondents on Iranian affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Arouzi.
Hi, Ian.
And first of all, let's touch on the arrival of the UN nuclear inspectors in Iran. That clearly indicates some kind of break. Do you know what went on behind the scenes to facilitate their arrival?
Well, I mean, Iran has been under a lot of pressure recently. I mean, it's been more pressure than they've faced since the Iran-Iraq war. So they want to be seen to be more conciliatory, to be more transparent, and that's why they've allowed this senior delegation of IAEA inspectors in. Iran says that they have nothing to hide, but the purpose of this IAEA delegation is to determine whether Iran has a secret nuclear weapons program. Now, Iran maintains that its program is purely for civilian purposes, and they say that they're going to prove this on this trip. But Western powers and analysts remain very skeptical about Iran's motives, saying that, you know, allowing in these inspectors and trying to restart nuclear talks is all a stalling tactic that's been employed by Tehran time and time again. So, I mean, we have to see what the net result of their visit will be. I mean, it's still even unclear whether these inspectors are going to be allowed to visit nuclear facilities. They may just be confined to talks with Iranian officials. But I think we'll get a better read on that once they've left the country in 3 days' time.
And the European sanctions are now in place. I think it was New Year's Eve that President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act. He was reluctant to sign it because he felt that sanctions against Iran could be sufficiently severe to bring about a shock, an oil price rise, which would not be good for the president in an election year. Apparently, he was able to get some language that gave him a little wiggle room and a 6 month grace period to allow customers of Iranian oil to find other suppliers. Well, it does look as though, my understanding is that Iran may preempt what is happening with the Europeans who've just joined in the sanction regime. The customers of Iranian oil, Greece, I think, Italy and Spain, Iran may cut off the oil preemptively before they get the 6 months period to find other suppliers. Is that something you're hearing?
Yes, I mean, we've actually got an in report today that Iran's oil minister, just about half an hour ago, released a statement saying that Iran would soon stop supplying oil to certain countries. They've definitely dug in on this issue there. As you said, they've preempted these sanctions move. What the U.S. and the European Union wanted to do was wean certain countries off Iranian oil and give them 6 months to do this. Now, if Iran stops selling oil to these European countries, as of, say, tomorrow, certain countries that are dependent on Iranian oil are going to be scrambling to find an alternative source, which could send oil prices sky high and really disrupt the market. And this is a fairly shrewd move from the Iranians. They're figuring, listen, if you guys are going to stop buying our oil in 6 months' time, well, we're going to make life very difficult for you today. As goes with the example for the Strait of Hormuz. I don't think Iran would just suddenly shut the Strait of Hormuz tomorrow, but if their oil supplies were disrupted to, say, Asia, China, and beyond, then they would disrupt the Strait of Hormuz because they're not getting anything out of it either. So, yeah, there is a lot of saber-rattling, but behind that saber-rattling, there's some pragmatism by Iran. I don't think they're just going to pull a stunt without thinking about it, but if they feel the pressure, they're certainly going to make everybody else feel the pressure.
Well, clearly closing the Straits of Hormuz on the surface appears to be would be a self-inflicted wound. If they do preemptively cut off supplies to the European countries that have been used to the Iranian supplies and that have now joined in this new sanctions regime that the Europeans have adopted, isn't that likely to have an effect on the price of oil pretty much immediately, right?
It certainly would, but in the meantime, before those sanctions could be implemented, and if Iran stops selling oil to the European Union or certainly even temporarily disrupts the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz, yes, oil prices would go way up, but that would also benefit Iran because it's still selling its oil to Asia. So they would benefit greatly by, you know, a huge hike in oil prices. So they'd calculated that as well. So in this short-term period of 6 months before those sanctions are implemented, Iran could make a lot of money from oil revenues.
And this is the very thing that President Obama was trying to avoid and why he was threatening to sanction the National Defense Authorization Act in the first place.
That's right. But I mean, what he was trying to do is something that I don't think anybody else has tried to do. And it's a very difficult thing to do, is trying to freeze out OPEC's second largest oil exporter without a hike in oil prices. Now, that's a tall order for anybody to pull off.
Right. So what is the feeling in Iran? Is there a sense of war fever there? Because clearly the West and Iran are on a collision course. There were some recent maneuvers in the Straits of Hormuz with the Iranian Navy, threats against the U.S. Navy, the threats to close the Straits, another naval exercise is coming up in February. Apparently, the U.S. and the Israelis have cancelled a joint exercise that they were planning. Excuse me, but the general atmosphere is one of spilt gasoline and the likelihood of somebody is going to strike a match.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's a lot of tension here amongst the working people. They definitely feel the faint murmur of a war drum beating. We were up in the Strait of Hormuz last week. We did a piece that aired last Friday on the nightly news. We went up into the Strait and, you know, you could taste the tension there. People, the regular fishmongers and fishermen were worried about, the Fifth Fleet being right on their doorstep. So there is definitely a sense of anticipation here. People are worried. They saw a very long war. Most people that are of a certain age here saw the 8-year war with Iran and Iraq, and they don't want a repeat of that. And they've, heard some very fiery language from both sides. But, unfortunately, in these situations, it's the working man, it's the cab driver, the fisherman that pays, the unreasonable price for Iran's standoff with the West. And people are suffering right now. You can see that the bite of the sanctions taking effect through the country. The dollar has skyrocketed. Food produce has gone up. Price of gasoline is expensive. So things are very tough here right now.
Well, I suppose the theory behind the sanctions, Ali Arouzi, is that the tougher you make the sanctions for the Iranian people, the more pressure they put on their government, and then the government somehow will accede to the demands from the West. Is that logic likely to apply to the current situation?
Absolutely. I mean, from from one swathe of the population that would, but you know, Iran is a massive country with huge factions, and one of the effects, if you know, if the government plays its propaganda properly, one of the effects of that could be that it would galvanize support for the regime, because you know, as they keep saying, the enemy is at the gate. Be aware that we've been telling you that they want to hurt Iran, that they want to cripple the nuclear program, that they want to sanction us. So this may give some support to the government. It's very hard to tell as we go further. You know, that balance will even itself out. Also, the government here is very worried about parliamentary elections coming up on the 2nd of March, and these are going to be the first elections since the disputed elections of 2009. So there's all sorts of pressure and tension in Iran.
Well, I understand, though, again, I speak with Ali Arouzi, the NBC bureau chief in Tehran, Iran, who's one of the few Western journalists operating in Iran. And as he mentioned, he's been back from the Straits of Hormuz, where he's reporting for NBC's nightly news. And my understanding, though, is that the politics in the country are largely disputes between the two, you know, elements of the political right, if you will, the Speaker of the Parliament and the President, Ahmadinejad. The elections, are they likely to have any other representatives of the people that came out during the Green Revolution?
It's unlikely. I mean, you know, senior members of the more moderate side have all but asked people to boycott the elections. But you know, there's also a large swathe of people that will put their votes forward. But it's, you know, people are waiting to see what's going to happen. It's going to be a very, very tense time. We're not sure how many people are going to come out and vote, or if there's going to be tension. So, but. For all intents and purposes, the Green Movement has become somewhat irrelevant, and none of the people that were involved in that would be involved in these elections. It will be a battle between the hardliners.
And it seems that that Ahmadinejad is more and more isolated. Perhaps the Supreme Leader is kind of sorry that he supported him over those disputed elections, and. Is it likely that he'll be replaced?
I think that would cause far too much turmoil. They'd probably rather see him finish his term without too much noise. But you know, things in Iran are predictably unpredictable, and you never know what's going to happen from day to day. But I wouldn't entirely write off the president. You know, he's a pretty feisty guy, and he claims to have all sorts of files and things on all sorts of people. So it seems as though he has protected himself to a certain degree as well.
Well, Ali Arouzi, there was a very disturbing front page story in Friday's New York Times. Israelis assess threats by Iran as partly bluff, belief that an attack will not stir chaos. And essentially the article, which is quite a lengthy article, suggests, quoting a lot of Israeli war planners and strategic think tank specialists, etc., suggesting that if Israel were to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, there may not be a lot of casualties, and that a likely response from Hezbollah could be handled, if you will. And this seems to be suggesting a rather dangerous direction, because the deterrent, apparently, what my understanding is that the U.S. administration has been leaning on Israel not to attack and saying they want nothing to do with it because of the consequences being so dire, shutting off the Straits of Hormuz, etc. But now we're hearing, at least via this front page New York Times story, that people in Israel think that Iran is bluffing. What's your sense on the ground?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, Iran is they have a strong army. They don't have much of an air force, but they have a huge missiles program, and they're not somebody to be trampled on. You know, the Revolutionary Guard are a very proud force, and they've always claimed how strong they are. So, I think if they're cornered and they're put under pressure, they could do something unpredictable. you know, an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities would be taken extraordinarily seriously by the government here, and they wouldn't want to be seen taking it lying down. So, yeah, I mean, I think a retaliation could be on the cards. Another extreme danger also is that, you know, we've seen Iranian Navy speedboats come very close to U.S. carriers in the Persian Gulf, and if an overzealous Iranian Navy boat commander makes some small miscalculation, that could also escalate matters much further.
Well, when the official with the Iranian nuclear program was recently assassinated by a magnetic car bomb that was attached to his car, what was, I thought, unusual about that, Ali Arouzi, was that the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, went public and condemned the attack and said the U.S. had nothing to do with it and vehemently disapprove of such actions. The assumption is that it was the Israelis. What was apparently going on at the time also was that the State Department were meeting in Turkey with the speaker, Larijani, had showed up at this meeting where both sides are trying to sort of back away from the brink, if you will. And there are suspicions in the U.S. that Israel did this in order to scuttle the diplomatic track. But my point is that the response in Iran was not so much to blame Israel, but to blame the United States, in spite of the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, distancing herself from the act. So if that's the MO, if Iran does not want to blame Israel for what Israel does, if Israel were to attack, would they blame the United States?
Undoubtedly. They've said it time and time again that any attack by Israel, Iran would see America complicit in the attack as well, and that that American bases in the region or American interests in the region would be targeted by Iran if Israel was to attack. So there's no doubt about that. And Iran also went very heavy on the assassination of the nuclear scientist, saying that, you know, this bore all the hallmarks of the CIA in collusion with Mossad. So anything Israel does, Iran will see America complicit in it. And you know, the point is, we all know that on the off chance that Israel did attack Iran, whether America liked it or not, they'd be drawn into it and they'd have to finish off what Israel started, and Iran is fully aware of that.
But what is the reason, though, why, in the case of this recent assassination, why does not Iran go after Israel first? Why does it blame the U.S.? Is it because they don't want to?
They blame them both here. I mean, Israel was blamed, you know, very firmly as well by the government and media. They were both blamed for the attack. Iran squarely laid the blame on Israel and the United States.
But I was trying to determine whether or not public opinion would be inflamed if they were to blame Israel, and would that therefore put them in a situation where they'd have to do something about it? I mean, that's
well. I mean, they have blamed Israel in the past, and that, you know, they've threatened they'll only do something if Israel attacks Iran. Iran also said that, you know, I mean, again, this is part of the bluster, but, you know, senior intelligence officials here said that, you know, Iran would now considering targeting, you know, Israeli military and officials if this was to happen again. So Iran has put a warning out there to Israel, saying that they are going to consider their own covert missions as well.
Well, I thank you for joining us here. This is clearly, obviously people in the United States are not particularly concerned, except those that have a real interest in this subject matter. But I take it that people in Iran are feeling that things could get out of hand.
Certainly. There's definitely a worry here that things could get out of hand. And, you know, Iran has lived under pressure since, you know, the Islamic Revolution 32 years ago, under an immense amount of pressure. So, and they've seen things quickly escalate. So, yes, there's definitely a lot of tension in the country and worries about how the future is going to pan out.
Well, Ali Arouzi, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ali Arouzi, who is the NBC bureau chief in Tehran, Iran, one of the few Western journalists operating in the country. He was born in Iran and his family moved to London when Islamic revolutionaries deposed the Shah. He first returned to his native country in 2004 to report on the massive Iranian earthquake and has since become one of NBC's chief correspondents on Iranian affairs. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back at getting a second opinion on this very important and dangerous subject. وسعت نام تو وسعت نام خورشید جلوه خاک تو قرمز و سبز و سپید این نوانم من نوان منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک در ایران. ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله‌گاه من شده خاک کوی تو. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kelly Golnoush Nikdijad, who is a native of Iran and the founder and editor-in-chief of Tehran Bureau. Her work includes reporting for PBS Frontline, the Los Angeles Times, San Diego Union Tribune, Time, Foreign Policy, and California Lawyer. She launched Tehran Bureau in 2008, and it's now in partnership with PBS's Frontline. Their first editorial partnership was on the documentary A Death in Tehran, which won an Emmy for continuing coverage of news stories. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kelly Golnoush Nikdijad.
Thank you for having me.
And what was your impression of the report from Tehran? And as you know, Kelly, it's pretty difficult to get any reports out of Tehran from Western sources. Ali Arouzi is one of the few people working there. What's your sense of whether the U.S. and Iran or the West and Iran are on a collision course?
It surely seems to be going that way. And I think at this point, I mean, it's been going on for a long time. This rhetoric has been escalating, unfortunately, has continued to get worse and not better. And at this point, I think most people are afraid that something might happen, not deliberately, but as a result of a miscalculation or an accident, because everyone is making all kinds of threats and possibly bluffing, not just from one side, from other sides as well, trying to force the other person's hand. But it's just a very dangerous place to be, especially since, there is no diplomatic relations. There's no way of communicating with Iran. This situation didn't even exist during the height of the Cold War with Soviet Union. So it's just a very dangerous, intense situation, and it seems to be escalating.
So the analogy with the Cold War and the Soviet Union is that at least when they had tensions and standoffs in the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviets had a hotline. There's no such thing. I guess in case of communicating, I think the U.S. communicates through the Swiss embassy, does it not?
Yes, that's the official, semi-official channel, yes. It's actually been one of the issues over the past decades is when they're trying to talk to Iran, they're not sure who to go about talking to. And there's so many people who speak for the government that it's easy to dismiss it. Like, after the, American-led war in Iraq and negotiations, the Iranians, putting out an offer of negotiating with the United States on a lot of the sensitive issues. And it's because there's so many people, there's so many factions, and probably deliberately so many people speaking on its behalf, it can always say we didn't get the message, or no, they had no authorization to speak on our behalf or negotiate on our behalf. So they've made it intentionally very muddy and opaque. And so not only is there no hotline, there's just no way of knowing if you've actually reached the people that you need to reach.
So in this delicate, dangerous, and dysfunctional situation, tensions are growing. The president, when he signed the National Defense Authorization Act, most of the attention it got was because of its the civil liberties assault that outraged a number of people, both on the left and the right in this country. And that got most of the attention. But the reason why the president threatened to veto the NDAA was because of the sanctions against Iran. He felt that they could bring about a precipitous rise in gasoline during an election year. And it looks like, for all of his efforts to avoid that, it's going to happen. If what Ali Arousi was telling us was that Iran plans now to cut off immediately its oil supplies to the European countries, its European customers, and Europe, of course, has just joined in these sanctions. And that will have a very, very a real and apparent effect on the price of oil, will it not?
Yes, I mean, even if that never happens, even if it is bluffing or it isn't, just the fact that there's so much speculation and so much threatening, the oil market has and will continue to react to it. So it's probably already achieved its goal and will continue to do so.
Well, but it's a win-win for Iran, isn't it, in terms of brinkmanship? They threaten to cut off the European oil immediately because they're going to lose these customers in 6 months at any rate. So they figure, well, we're not going to help you with your sanctions against us. And then the oil markets react and the price of oil goes up. And guess who benefits? Iran.
Exactly. I mean, that seems to be the case. If anything, I mean, it could be that Iran doesn't believe the European Union can actually go through with the sanctions and whether it's really possible to do so, even though they say, and maybe they believe that this six-month period is just ways of putting more pressure on it, and Iran is kind of exactly doing the same thing but benefiting as well. A lot can happen between now and 6 months.
So, Kelly Golnish, Nick Najat, again, with the Tehrin Bureau, which is now in partnership with the PBS Frontline. The Friday's New York Times carried a front-page story: Israelis assess threats by Iran as partly bluff, belief that an attack will not stir chaos. And this is a very thorough and long article, quoting a number of senior Israeli defense officials and strategists in Israeli think tanks, saying that an attack on Iran may not be as apocalyptic as most analysts have suggested. That the assumption has been that the U.S. has basically been leaning on Israel not to attack Iran simply because the consequences would be too dire for the Western economies, that would lead to an automatic shutdown of the Straits of Hormuz and perhaps a retaliation against Saudi Arabia, and it would be a complete catastrophe. And, of course, that's not something that a president in an election year wants to be faced with. Now we're getting these reports via the New York Times that the Israelis are saying, well, it doesn't have to be that way. You know, we can still attack Iran without the Straits of Hormuz being closed.
It's hard to know whether I think the Israelis are too smart to believe that it would be that easy. I think that as the former chief of Mossad has come out and publicly gone against the narrative that is being put forth by the Israeli government, it shows that even the Israelis continue probably to have a split in their leadership in terms of what to do about Iran. To show how pragmatic the Iranian government is with respect to Israel is just the example you use when you're asking Ali about why is it that when the last scientist was assassinated and so close to the intelligence ministry, and when the United States came out and said condemned the attack, but then there was reports in Israeli newspapers that Someone had told them about, you know, the details of how Mossad was, observing what these scientists were doing. They're going, just basically almost boasting about the fact that they were behind it. And if, in fact, have been behind the other attacks on the scientists, you would think that, you know, Iran has all the reasons it needs right now to get back at Israel. Instead, you see how they try to deflect the pressure by coming and saying, you know, we have evidence that the United States was behind it. And, you know, again, this is so that the United States, which has, you know, been more pragmatic than, been more even-headed about the whole situation, to put pressure on Israel to stop. Because if Iran were an existential threat to Israel, I think that we would have seen warfare and more retaliation than we've seen. So it really shows the issue is seems to be much more about a power game in the region than any specific threat to Israel's existence.
But that's not to say, surely, Kelly Golnish, Nick Najad, if there were to be an Israeli attack on the Iranian, if there were to be an Israeli attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities, that the there wouldn't be a response. I mean, surely Hezbollah would respond with barrages of missiles. That's why Iran's been supplying them, surely.
Yes, of course. I mean, I'm sure. Of course there would be. They would definitely retaliate. But, some of the analysts, I mean, I'm basing a lot of what I'm saying on what on my conversations with the analysts, a lot of them, some of them in Iran, and they believe that, you know, the situation in Iran is so dire that it wouldn't be out of the thinking of the leadership to actually want something like that to happen. It would be a blow to Iran, I mean, to its military. But if the end justifies the means, if, like the 1979 playbook, when, you know, 1980 Iraq, thought that Iran is very weak at this moment and there's chaos in the country and an attack that they weren't able to launch on Iran when the Shah was in power because it was much stronger, would be much more successful. That didn't happen to be the case. I think Iran, the way it's been explained to me, is that that's exactly what they did, in their reaction to the Green Movement. Instead of showing leniency, as the Shah ultimately did when he was faced with protests in the streets, he relented. And I think that leniency opened up more space for the revolution to succeed. So I think going by that same period's playbook, an attack on Iran could actually revitalize it. It would have retaliated, of course. And ultimately, it doesn't need the entire population or even a majority of the population to rally behind it. It's enough that a very small group of very ardent supporters who are militarized, who know only to how to exist in these types of situations, if they alone themselves rally behind the government, then it's very successful. And right now, if you follow Tehran Bureau, you'll see that there's been more and more opposition, factionalism within the Revolutionary Guards themselves, within the hardline camp, and it would be a very effective way of getting those people to rally behind each other and helps consolidate the government's control over the government. So, in a sense, an attack, I think the people who, an attack would achieve that, could possibly achieve that for the government. I think it's a little wishful thinking to believe that something like that could bring about a coup, because if the Israelis are thinking that, if the Americans are thinking that, you can be sure the Iranians thought that before they did and took the necessary steps to make sure that there wasn't any kind of coup within. This is right after the revolution. They established a parallel military, the Revolutionary Guards, the Basij, so that the military couldn't rise up against the regime just as it did against the Shah before the revolution. So there's all these parallels and examples and that seem to show a pattern in the thinking of the regime in Iran.
So, Kelly Golnish, Nick Najad, there pretty much aren't any politics left in Iran, right? The Green Movement's been extinguished. The notion of the embers burning under the ashes that the Nobel laureate suggested may well be wishful thinking. It seems to me that there are only political battles are between two right-wing factions, Ahmadinejad's, the president's, and the speaker's, Larijani's, faction. He's Larijani's closer to the supreme leader. There have been reports, in fact, in the CNN report that the series of articles that you were included in, one of the specialists on Iran suggested that the supreme leader was sorry that he backed Ahmadinejad after the election dispute. So what you're saying is that if there was, that were an even a limited Israeli attack on Iran, the people would rally, it would unite the right-wing factions. But is there anything left on the other side that could generate a coup?
No, I don't think they have the strength. I think there is a lot of resentment, but I don't get the indication that anyone has the stomach to carry that out. If anyone could carry a coup against the government, it would probably be within the Revolutionary Guards, and I think they've taken steps. I would imagine if I were them, they would have taken the steps necessary to make sure that doesn't happen. I don't think they know themselves how divided the Revolutionary Guard is and how much any of that dissent is serious and how far it can go. So it's been a very interesting area to watch because so much of the fighting has become public. Four Revolutionary Guards passed away recently, and the Supreme Leader didn't send his condolences to the family. And then there was a father of another Revolutionary Guard who passed away, and he did exactly the opposite thing and publicly relayed his grievance for father's death. And then there's been a lot of things happening on that front that are very interesting, and they've raised a lot of speculation about what's going on in the Revolutionary Guards. That's where an attack, that's where a coup could come from. And I'm sure that if it were a real threat, it would have been neutralized by now. And then secondly, just to show how dangerous it is, I don't think the barometer should be whether the Iranian people do want or do not want a nuclear program, a peaceful nuclear program. I don't think that's so much the issue. I think once you start attacking Iran, the sense of nationalism will kind of will rise again. Again, everybody will start rallying around the same flag. And just as a small indication of that, when we had the last assassination against nuclear scientists, there were so many. The tide just turned in terms of sentiments. A lot of Iranians Iraq people of Iranian descent started writing columns and making Facebook pages saying that, stop killing our nuclear scientists. You could see that even on a on an assassination scale, they were able to get people get the nationalist flames going up. And you can imagine what an attack would accomplish. So as much as Iran doesn't want an attack, I think it's also very important to consider the consequences of it solidifying power in a way that it wouldn't be able to do, or it doesn't seem to be able to do in terms of its own inner factional fighting.
So just in closing then, Kelly Golnish, Nick Najad, what did you make of the front page story in Friday's New York Times, a very thorough story talking about how Israelis assess threats by Iran as partly bluff, and they believe that an attack by Israel would not stir the chaos that that analysts have suggested. It seems to be the point of the article, I guess, is that, at the highest levels in Israel, people are suggesting that the unthinkable is thinkable.
I think they might be bluffing as well. I think that they know the only way the Iranian government will change its behavior or do anything differently is if they truly believe that something will lead to a regime change. So unless they're making calculations, a limited military strike on its nuclear facilities, I don't believe would accomplish that. But if I think they're just trying to get their backs against the wall even more than it already is right now, making it very difficult and making it suffocating for them. But, right now I would like to believe that they're bluffing as well.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Kelly Golnish-Nikdarjad, who is the editor-in-chief of Tehran Bureau, a news independent news organization in that is in works in tandem with PBS's Frontline. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll get an update on what is happening in Egypt, where the son of a U.S. cabinet member is being held by the Egyptian military.
At least, it's not the end of the world.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Cairo, Egypt, is Sharif Geber, who's a recent graduate of law from the University of Texas Law School in Austin. And he is now back in his native Egypt and has been active with the group No Military Trials for Civilians. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sharif Geber.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And let's just start with the demonstrations in Tahrir Square that have been ongoing. My understanding is that that many of the young secular Egyptians who led the original revolution a year ago, who really did the heavy lifting, if you will, they were heckling the Muslim Brotherhood, who dominated the square with a big stage and a big sound, loudspeakers, etc. Mm-hmm. And the young secular Egyptians were sort of hurling insults and empty bottles of water at the Brotherhood. So give us a sense of what's happening in this post-revolutionary factionalism, if you will.
Well, yeah, it's been incredibly exciting the past few days, because more than just Tahrir Square, we've seen people taking back to all of Egypt's streets. We've seen enormous marches, sizes larger than perhaps even the first 18 days of the revolution, covering the streets of Cairo and all of the Egyptian governors. And then when you look in Tahrir Square, the Muslim Brotherhood, who are very pleased with their victory in a parliament that a lot of the revolutionaries are very upset about, the process that elections took and the course they took, particularly since they took place at the back of 5 days of bloodshed in the streets of Cairo. People were upset that the fact that they came to celebrate, whereas the majority of us see that the revolution continues, that the demands have largely been unmet and that there's a long way to go. And so beyond kind of splitting along secular versus Islamic grounds or secular versus religious grounds, this was really a struggle over representation between those who saw the revolution as continuing and those who saw it as ending with the kind of first ballot boxes.
So, Sharif, is there a belief amongst the young revolutionaries that somehow the Brotherhood worked behind the scenes with the military junta to get the favorable election results that they've got?
No, I think that absolutely. I mean, whether they work behind the scenes or simply out in the open, we've seen, if not outright collusion, then we've seen a lining up of interests that has played into their favor against the goals of the revolution. At the end of this five-day street battle on Muhammad Mahmoud Street in November, the Muslim Brotherhood came down and basically formed quarters in front of the police and facing the protesters, pushing us away in order to kind of maintain an artificial calm and dampen the situation so that elections would proceed as normal. They are very happy with kind of controlling the parliament, and I think that they have no kind of other strong desires to advance anything that the revolution stood for at this point, which is seen as a betrayal.
So Sharif Gaber, again, a recent graduate from the University of Texas Law School in Austin. He's back in his native Egypt, and he's been active with a group called No Military Trials for Civilians. And what's it been, about 5,000 civilians being detained by the military since the revolution?
Well, the numbers was actually 12,000 brought before military courts as of September. But I think that the situation now is very different than when the campaign started, because on the one hand, I think the pressure in the streets and pressure against the Armed Forces Council is kind of demonstrating the kind of absolute injustice of these military court-martials of civilians, since how the army can largely stop the process, although we still have several thousand people still in prison.
So, Sharif, let's talk about what's happening with Sam LaHood, the son of a cabinet minister. My understanding is that President Obama called Tantawi, who's the field marshal in head of the military junta, and basically told him to get out of the way. And then suddenly they detain Sam LaHood, the son of the U.S. Secretary of Transport, Ray LaHood. So it seems like the Egyptian military are trying to play the anti-American card for all it's worth.
Yeah, I think so. And this is a tactic that we definitely saw used by the Mubarak government during the first 18 days, is sort of tactical use of xenophobia to attempt to discredit the revolution and revolutionaries and human rights organizations, journalists, anyone who would seek to help cover the events. And this doesn't simply apply to foreigners. This also applies to Egyptians who might not fit a certain stereotype or generally. So this detention seems to be kind of an escalation, some sort of brinksmanship on behalf of the junta. But in the end, I mean, they do take over $1 billion a year from the American government in direct aid. So it'll be interesting to see what happens as they're biting the hand that feeds them.
Well, this billion and a half, I think it is, comes out of the Camp David Accord, and it's created apparently quite a dependency and a lot of military industry and a big revolving door between the generals and the military contractors there in Egypt. So they've been on this gravy train for some time. Given the Saudi support for the Salafists, who've done surprisingly well, is there any talk in Egypt that if the U.S. pulls its money out, the Saudis will simply replace the money?
I mean, I don't know that this has necessarily been a public discussion. I mean, we've definitely seen a lot of concern from some areas about Saudi funding of the Salafis. But I think that whether or not they're funded from abroad or whether or not there is Saudi money coming into the country, the kind of political negotiations and the political struggles that we're having here are going to take place, with ordinary Egyptians fighting for kind of basic social justice issues in many respects that no kind of amount of either military or religiously tainted money is going to change the fact that ordinary Egyptians want advancements in social justice. They want dignity. They want to end police brutality. And wherever the money comes from to fund whatever political organization, these are still going to be issues that bring people to the streets.
But is the anti-Americanism working? I mean, first of all, I've spoken with a lot of Egyptian revolutionaries, if you will, over the last year. And they're very upset about the made-in-the-U.S. tear gas canisters that have been fired at them. What's the response now to this somewhat transparent attempt on the part of military to tap into anti-Americanism? Is it working?
Well, I think that it's happening on two different sides. I think that, as revolutionaries, we're incredibly you know, appalled at the behavior of the United States, which will kind of talk about democracy promotion on the one hand, and then back both the Mubarak government for a long time it did, and the military regime on the other hand. I mean, I was blanketed in that same American-made tear gas, and then saw that another shipment of 21 tons arrived at the port in Suez a week after the violence had stopped. I mean, and for the military to kind of attempt to play this card, it works in their favor sometimes, but we know in the end, and I think that the Egyptian people are realizing in the end, their complicity with the Americans, with the State Department, and seeing how that game is actually being played.
And is there any connections with the U.S. State Department and the Muslim Brotherhood, since they've got 75% of the seats in the parliament and the revolutionaries that that you support?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Americans, you know, you've seen from Hillary Clinton to John Kerry, you've seen public officials in the States meeting with the Muslim Brotherhood even before the parliamentary elections even started. I think that whether or not they're just trying to cut their losses and make sure that they have a friendly ally in the seat of power in Egypt or what their plan is, I mean, there's a clear perception that the Americans are not interested in any kind of real democracy and any kind of real revolution in Egypt. And the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, as much as the specter of Islamism is raised, is ultimately just a conservative party with economic policies that are incredibly amenable to America and international business interests.
So, again, you and your fellow revolutionaries feel you've been shafted, right? You did all the bleeding and the dying, and, well, I don't want to be pessimistic on the just in closing. Give me a sense of where things are going to head.
I think that, you know, we avoid pessimism by realizing that the struggle continues after seeing so many hundreds of thousands in the streets in the past few days. We realize that we have the strength to continue and that we will continue. I mean, we knew that this would be difficult. We knew that all powers were against us, and, you know, that's why we said we demand the end of the regime, and we meant that in the broadest sense possible, and I think we're going to continue taking to the streets. We're going to continue, you know, fighting for the kind of goals of the revolution, as simple, as complex as they may be, and whether we're pessimistic in the short term as far as who will give us what, I mean, we're in the end not demanding anything of these powers other than they basically leave us to kind of build a better world.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us there from Cairo, Egypt. Sharif Gaber, again, recent graduate from the University of Texas Law School. He's back in his native Egypt, and he's been active with the group No Military Trials for Civilians. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Ali Arouzi, who's the NBC bureau chief in Tehran. He's one of the few Western reporters that's operating inside of Iran, and it's unusual to be able to get through and talk to somebody there on the ground. And he has to be, you know, cautious about what he says. But on the other hand, he was pretty frank and open about how, in effect, in spite of these sanctions, which the European Union have now joined in, particularly the banking sanctions, which makes it all but impossible for Iran to get paid for its oil, President Obama, of course, when he signed the National Defense Authorization Act, he was concerned about forcing a sudden oil shock in the price of oil. And he got a waiver in there that he could bring the sanctions in gradually so that countries that were customers of Iranian oil could get weaned off the oil in a six-month period. Well, it looks like the Iranians have got the jump on the U.S. and the Europeans. Now they're threatening, apparently, to immediately cut off oil to the European customers who've joined in the sanctions, denying them the possibility of finding alternative supplies. And, of course, that will have a severe shock on the price of oil, the very thing that President Obama has been apparently trying to avoid. So it looks as though, in spite of Iran's isolation, they seem to be playing things fairly rationally and fairly well. And that is, you know, obviously there's a lot of brinksmanship going on here. But so far, if this is to happen, as our first guest suggested, that the Iranian oil minister had just announced it about an hour before we went on the air today, then this could be quite a shock. We followed through on the with this subject matter even further with the editor-in-chief of Tehran Bureau, who works in conjunction in partnership with PBS's Frontline. And we talked with her, Kelly Golnish Niknajad, following on from our first interview with the bureau chief in Tehran. We talked further about the possibility of this situation backfiring in the short term. She felt that when the scientist or the nuclear program person was recently assassinated, she thought it was telling that the Iranians, in spite of Hillary Clinton's denials, blamed the United States because they don't really want to blame Israel. And so she felt that if there were any Israeli attack, they would use the same MO and blame the United States. We talked a lot about this report in the New York Times on Friday, coming out of Israel, saying that a number of senior military analysts and senior military officials, along with people in the military think tanks in Israel, are now suggesting that the unthinkable, that is an attack on Iran, is actually not so unthinkable, that it won't lead to the chaos that many are predicting and the catastrophe and the closing of the Straits of Hormuz, that the Iranians are bluffing. After all, if they cut off the Straits of Hormuz, that would be a self-inflicted wound. So I asked her to look into that scenario at length, and she seemed to think that the basic premise that you could attack Iran and somehow the people would rise up in favor of Israel and the West is an absurd proposition, and that, in fact, if anything, it would unite the right-wing factions that are fighting each other. And then finally, we spoke with Sharif Gaber, who's an independent blogger active with the No Military Trials for Civilians in Egypt, in Tahrir Square. He gave us a flavor of how the young revolutionaries are bored about this revolution that ended up putting the Muslim Brotherhood in power, how they feel that they've been had, but they're not giving up. They're going to continue the fight. And he feels that the military, of course, are clearly trying to play the anti-American card, holding the son of an American, of Obama cabinet minister, Sam LaHood. But at the end of the day, he seemed to think that in spite of the bitterness about having fought and died for a revolution that's ended up in the hands of religious conservatives, that the revolutionaries aren't about to give up. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and also Nicholas Walrath, our assistant today. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Sing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here run the free. One time, one night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night. Just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. Five. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.